This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents She is the Darkness, written by Glenn Cook and narrated by Jonathan Davis.
The wind whines and howls with bitter breath. Lightning snarls and barks. Rage is an animate force upon the plain of glittering stone. Even shadows are afraid. The scars of cataclysm disfigure a plain that has known only an age of dark perfection. A jagged fissure lies like a lightning slash across its face. Nowhere is that fissure so wide that a child could not step across, but it seems bottomless. Trailers of mist drift forth. Some bear a hint of color. Any color clashes with a thousand blacks and grays. At the heart of the plain stands a vast gray stronghold, unknown, older than any written memory. One ancient tower has collapsed across the fissure. From the heart of the fastness comes a great, deep, slow beat, like that of a slumbering world heart, cracking the olden silence. Death is eternity. Eternity is stone. Stone is silence. Stone cannot speak, but stone remembers.
Chapter 1. The old man looked up. His quill twitched, betraying his irritation at being interrupted.
"What is it, Mergen?"
"I went for a walk with the ghost. The earth tremor we felt a while ago."
"What about it? And don't give me none of that around-the-bush crap One-Eye's always handing out. I don't have time for it."
"The farther south you go, the worse the destruction is." The old man opened his mouth, closed it to think some before he said anything else.
"Croker, the old man, the captain of the Black Company, the right now, by God, military dictator of Taglios and all its tributaries, dependencies, and protectorates, doesn't look the part. He's in his middle 50s, possibly closer to 60. He stands more than 6 feet tall. He's grown slightly heavy during 4 years, spent mainly in garrison. He has a high forehead with a feeble crop of hair farther back. Lately he's been affecting a beard on his chin. It's grizzled. So is what hair still lurks upon his head. His icy blue eyes are deeply set, giving him a hard, scary look, like some kind of psychopathic killer. He doesn't know. Nobody ever told him. Sometimes he's hurt because people back off. He doesn't understand why. Mostly it's his eyes. They can be really spooky. He considers himself just one of the guys, most of the time. If he understood it, he would use his impact to its limit. His belief in the value of creating illusions in the minds of others borders on religious conviction. He stood up. "Let's go for a walk, Mergen." "In the palace, it's always best to be moving if you want to keep your conversations your own. The palace is vast, a honeycomb, networked with a labyrinth, masking countless secret passageways. I've been mapping those, but couldn't winkle them all out in a lifetime, even if we weren't heading south any day. The point is, there is always a chance our friends will be listening to anything we say. We've been very successful at driving our enemies out beyond arm's reach." Tydei picked us up at the doorway. The old man grimaced. "He has no personal prejudice against my bodyguard and brother-in-law, but he abhors the fact that so many company brothers have acquired similar companions, none of whom are bound to his direct command. He does not trust the Nguyen Bao. He never has, never will, and can't explain clearly why. He does understand that he wasn't there in Hell's Forge when the bonds were hammered into existence. He will stipulate that. He's done his time in other hells. He was suffering one at that time." I made a small gesture to Tydei. He dropped back a step, symbolically acknowledging our need for privacy, rather than actually accepting it. He would hear everything we had to say anyway. So every word we said would be spoken in the dialect of the Jewel City Beryl, which lies 6,000 miles beyond the edge of any world Ty Day can even imagine. I wondered why Croker bothered walking when he was going to use an alien tongue. No Taglian would understand a word. "Tell me," he said. I walked with the ghost. I went south. I made the routine checks. I was just following the daily ritual. I understood his desire to walk. Soul Catcher. Soul Catcher understood the Jewel City's dialects. She would have more trouble eavesdropping if she had to find us first. "Thought I told you to ease up. You're spending too much time out there. It'll hook you. It's too easy to shake loose from the ache. That's why I don't go anymore." I masked my pain. "That's not a problem, boss." He wouldn't believe me. He knew just how much Sari meant to me, how much I missed her, how much I hurt. I'm handling it. "Anyway, what I want you to know is, the farther south you look, the worse the damage done by that earthquake gets. Am I supposed to be concerned? Dare I hope that you'll tell me the Shadow Master's house fell in on his head? You can hope all you want, but you won't hear it from me. Not now. His faults don't include being a bad architect." "I had a feeling you wouldn't tell me what I wanted to hear. You're no fun at all that way." Part of my job as analyst is to remind my superiors that they aren't gods. It didn't happen this time. Overlook came through almost unscathed, but Kialune was destroyed. Thousands were killed. The way disasters go, thousands more will die from hunger, disease, and exposure. The heart of winter was fast approaching. Kialune is the southernmost city of men. Its name means Shadow Gate. When he came out of nowhere 2 decades ago and made himself master of the province, the Shadow Master Long Shadow changed the name to Shadow Catch. Only the peoples of the Shadowlands, who were inclined to avoid the Shadow Master's displeasure, actually employ names enforced upon them by their enslavement. Is that good news? It'll sure slow down construction work on Overlook. Long Shadow won't like it, but he's going to have to take time out to help his subjects. Otherwise, he'll run out of people to do his work for him. Our parade continued slowly through busy hallways. This part of the palace had been given over to the war effort completely. Now people were packing. Soon, we would be heading south, bound toward a major and possibly final collision with the armies of the Shadow Masters. Most of our forces were in transit already, a slow and difficult process. It takes ages to move large numbers a great distance. The men in these offices had been laying the groundwork for years. Croker asked, "Are you saying we don't need to get in any big hurry?" "There's no need now. The quake crippled him. There wasn't any pressing need before the quake. We could have gotten there before he finished his oversized sand castle." "True. We were starting the campaign now mostly because the captain and his woman were so thirsty for revenge. Add the name Mergen to that list. My taste for vengeance was newer and bloodier. My wife was a more recent victim. Long Shadow and Narayan Singh would pay for Sari's death. Especially Narayan Singh. You living saint of the stranglers, your night-walking companion now hunts you too. Something that hurts him doesn't really change anything at our end." I agreed. "True, though it does give us more flexibility. Yet it makes sense to jump them while they're stunned. How widespread was the damage? Was it just Kialune? There's heavy damage everywhere south of the Danda Presh. It gets worse as you go farther south. Those people won't have much energy to spend trying to stop an invasion. All the more reason to stay on schedule. We'll stomp them while they're down." The old man was bitter and vindictive. Comes with the job, I guess. And because of all the evils done to him. "You ready to travel?" he asked. "Personally, me and my whole household have our preparations made. You name the day and we'll be on the road." My own bitterness leaked through. I kept telling myself not to let the need for vengeance sink roots too deep. I dared not let it become an obsession. Croker pursed his lips, sour for a moment. My household includes not only Tydei, but Sari's mother, Kigota, and Uncle Doge, who isn't really anybody's uncle, but is a family attachment nonetheless. Croker refuses to trust them, but he does not trust anybody who has not been a brother of the company for years. Proof was immediate. Mergen, I want you to add the Radishah to the list of people you check regularly. I'm betting that as soon as we clear the city wall, she'll start fixing to break our hearts. I didn't argue. It seemed likely. All through our history, the Black Company has suffered the ingratitude of our employers. Usually those blackguards received ample cause to regret their villainy. This time, there was a good chance we could subvert the effort before the Radishah Dra and her brother, the Prabhrindra Dra, could deal us any major treachery. Right now, the Radishah and Prince have to restrain themselves. As long as Long Shadow survives, the company will remain their lesser fear. I asked, you looked at those books yet?
Which books?
He could be exasperating. I snapped, the books I risked my precious ass to steal back from Soulcatcher the other night. The lost annals that are supposed to tell us why every damned fool lord and priest in this end of the world is scared shitless of the Black Company?
Oh, those books.
Yeah, those. I realized that he was ragging me. I haven't had time, Mergen. Although I did find out that we're going to need a translator. They aren't written in modern Taglian. I was afraid of that. We're taking the Ghostwalker south with us. The sudden shift surprised me. Lately he's been so paranoid, he won't mention Smoke, by name or otherwise, for any reason, even in a non-Taglian language. There's always a crow around somewhere. I replied, I assumed we would. The resource is too valuable to leave here. We don't want anyone to know if we can help it. The Radishah already wonders how come we find him so interesting that we'll take care of him and keep him alive. She no longer thinks there's any chance he'll recover. If she puts much thought into it, she might start adding things up. He shrugged. I'll talk to One Eye. You two can smuggle him out when nobody's looking. One more thing to do in my copious spare time.
Hey,
enjoy it while you can. Soon we'll get to sleep for ages. He's not a religious man. Chapter 2. I gotta do everything, One Eye grumbled. Anything that's got to be done, just stick it on old One Eye. He'll take care of it. I sneered. That's only if you can't find Mergen first. I'm too old for this shit, kid. I ought to be retired. The little black man had a point. According to the annals, he's about 200 years old, still alive mostly because of his own clever sorcery, and good luck beyond what any human being deserves. The two of us were inside a dark circular stairway, lugging a body down on a litter. Smoke didn't weigh much, but One Eye made the job a pain in the ass anyway. You about ready to trade off? I asked. I had the uphill end. I'm more than 6 feet tall. One Eye goes 5 feet if you stand him on a thick book, but he's a stubborn little shit who can never admit that he's wrong. For some reason, One Eye had it in his head that the downhill end of a litter would be the easy one to handle on a stairway.
Yeah, I think. When we get down to the next landing.
I grinned in the darkness. That would leave us with just one story to go. Then I grumbled, I hope that damned Sleepy is on time. Though barely 18, Sleepy is a 4-year veteran of the company. He went through the fire of Digigore with us. He still has a tendency to be late and a little irresponsible, but hell, he is still awful young. Youth made him the best man to be driving a wagon around Taglios in the middle of the night, if you didn't want to attract attention. A Vedna Taglian, he could pass as an apprentice easily. He could not be expected to know what he was doing. Apprentices do what they're told. Their masters seldom feel obliged to explain to them. The kid would have no clue what he was up to tonight. If he arrived on time, he wouldn't guess his part for years. He was supposed to wander off before the wagon acquired its mysterious burden. One Eye would take over after we loaded smoke. He would explain, if he found himself in a position where that became necessary, that the corpse back there was Goblin. No one would know the difference. Smoke hadn't been seen at all for 4 years, and seldom publicly before that. And Goblin hadn't been around for a while because the old man sent him off on a mission weeks ago. Anybody running into One Eye would know who he was right away. He's the most recognizable member of the company. His ugly old black hat gives him away even in the dark. It's so damned filthy it glows. I exaggerate only slightly. People would believe One Eye because everyone in Taglios knows the nasty little runt runs with a toad-faced little white wizard called Goblin. The trick would be to distract them from Smoke's skin color. Or One Eye could put a glamour on him and make him actually look enough like Goblin to deceive the Taglian Eye. Eventually somebody would discover that Smoke no longer was in the palace. Probably later. By accident. When somebody stumbled through the network of confusion spells surrounding the room where Smoke had lain hidden for years. Somebody would be the Rati Shadra. She and Uncle Doge are the only people, besides me and Croker and One Eye, who know Smoke is still alive, if unutterably lost in the land of coma. He's more useful now than he ever was when he was conscious, and the secret court wizard. Smoke had been as thoroughly craven as it's possible for a human to be. We reached the landing. One Eye damned near dropped his end of the litter. He was in a hurry to take a break.
"Let me know when you're ready," I told him. "You don't got to go smart-assing me, kid,"
he muttered a few words in a dead tongue, which was totally unnecessary and entirely for show. He could have said the same thing in Taglian and have achieved the same result, which was that a globe of shimmering swamp gas materialized above his ugly hat. Did I say anything?
"You don't got to talk, kid. You're grinning like a shit-eating dog."
But he was puffing too hard to keep it up.
"Old fart's heavier than he looks, isn't he?"
He was. Maybe because he was all lard after 4 years of sleep, getting his sustenance as soup and gravy and any other sludge I can spoon down him. He's a mess to take care of. I would let him croak if he wasn't so damned useful. The company wastes no love on this man. Maybe I like him better unconscious than conscious, though we never butted heads personally. I've heard so many horror stories about his cowardice that I can't say much in his favor at all. Well, he was a modestly effective fire marshal when he was awake. Fire is an enemy Taglios knows far more intimately than any remote Shadow Master. If he hadn't been such a chicken shit and gone over to Long Shadow, he wouldn't be in the sad shape he is now. For reasons unclear, even to One Eye, Smoke's comatose spirit is anchored to his flesh very loosely. Making a connection with his ka, which is what they might call it around here, is easy. It takes instructions well. I can connect with him, detach from my flesh and ride him almost anywhere to see almost anything. Which is why he's so special to us today. Which is why it's so critical to keep everything about him under wraps. If we succeed in this dark war, victory will come largely because we can walk with the ghost.
"I'm ready to go,"
One Eye said. "You come back fast for an old fart."
"You keep running your jaw, kid. You're never gonna get a chance to find out what it's like to be old enough to deserve respect, but not to get none from pops like you."
"Don't go picking on me because Goblin ran out on you.
Where the hell is that stunted mouse turd anyway?"
I knew. Or thought I knew. I walk with the ghost. One Eye didn't need to know, though, so I didn't clue him in. "Lift the damned litter, Limber Dick.
I just know you're going to enjoy life as a polecat, kid."
We hoisted the litter. Smoke made a gurgling sound. Foamy spit dribbled from the corner of his mouth.
"Hustle up. I need to get his mouth cleaned out before he drowns himself."
One Eye saved his breath. We clumped down the stairs. Smoke began making strangling noises. I kicked the door open and went through without looking outside first. We got into the street.
Put him down,
I snapped. Then cover us while I take care of him. Who knew what might be watching? Taglian Knights conceal countless curious eyes. Everyone wants to know what the Black Company is doing. We take it as a given that some of those are people we don't even know yet. Paranoia is a way of life. I knelt beside the litter, tipped it a little, and turned Smoke's head. It flopped like he had no bones in his neck. Smoke gurgled and hacked some more.
Hush,
One Eye said. I looked up. A tall Shadar watchman was headed our way, carrying a lantern. One of the old man's innovations, the nighttime foot patrols have crippled enemy espionage efforts. Now our creativity was about to turn around on us. The turbaned soldier walked past so close, his gray pants actually brushed me. But he sensed nothing. One Eye's no master sorcerer, but he does a hell of a job when he concentrates. Smoke made that noise again. The Shadar stopped, looked back. His eyes widened. They were about all that could be seen between his turban and his massive beard. I don't know what he saw, but he touched his forehead and swept his fingers in a quick half-circle, ending over his heart. That was a ward against evil, common to all the peoples of Taglios. He moved on hurriedly. What did you do? I asked.
Never mind, One Eye said. Let's get him loaded.
The wagon was waiting right where Sleepy was supposed to leave it.
He's going to report something. He'll have his whole family here in a few minutes.
The watchmen were equipped with whistles. Our man remembered his and started tooting as One Eye lifted his end of the litter. In seconds, another whistle answered.
He's going to keep that shit up?
One Eye asked.
I'll lay him on his side. The phlegm should drain off. But you're the guy who knows the medical stuff. If he's coming down with pneumonia, you better start working on him now. Go teach Granny to suck eggs, kid. Just shove the little bastard in the wagon, then get your ass back through that door. Shit. I think I forgot to wedge it open. I'd call you a dumb shit, but you keep ragging me about stating the obvious.
Ugh! He swung his end of the litter into the bed of the wagon. Good boy Sleepy had remembered to leave the tailgate down, exactly as he'd been instructed.
I remembered for you. You were the last one out anyway.
Damn, would I be glad when Goblin came back and One Eye could get back to feuding with him. I shoved my end of the litter. One Eye was scrambling up to the driver's seat already.
Don't forget to get that gate up!
I twisted Smoke's shoulders so his mouth would drain, raised the tailgate, and dropped the oak pins into their slots.
You check on him as soon as you're clear. Shut up and get out of here!
Whistles were shrieking all around us now. Sounded like every watchman on duty was closing in. Their interest was going to attract that of others. I ran for the postern door. Steel tires began to rattle on cobblestones behind me. One Eye was going to get a chance to test our cover story. Chapter 3. It's a long trail from that postern to the apartment I call home. On the way, I stopped by Croker's cell to let him know what had happened while we were getting Smoke out of the house. He asked,
"You see anything besides the Shadar?"
"No. But the uproar is going to attract attention. If they hear that One Eye was involved, people interested in us will start poking around. They'll be sure something was going on, even if One Eye sells his story to the Watchman." Croker grunted. He stared at the papers he'd been trying to read. He was bone-tired.
"Nothing we can do about it now. Go get some sleep. We're going ourselves in a day or two."
Ugh. I didn't look forward to traveling, especially during wintertime. I'm not really looking forward to this.
Hey,
I'm older and fatter than you are, but you'll be going towards something. Lady is down there. He grunted unenthusiastically. Anymore, you had to wonder about his commitment to his woman. Ever since the trouble with Blade, none of my business.
Good night, Mergen.
Yeah, same to you, Chief. He did not want to be civil. That was fine with me. I headed for my apartment, though there was nothing for me there but a bed that would give me no rest. With Sari gone, the place was a wasteland of the heart. I closed the door behind me, looked around like maybe she would jump out laughing and tell me it was all a bad joke, but the joke was not over yet. Mother Gota still hadn't finished cleaning up the mess left by the strangler raid, and, pushy though she was, she had not touched anything in my work area, where I was still sorting the burned remains of several of these annals. I must have gone drifting with my thoughts. Suddenly, I was aware that I was not alone. I got a knife out in half a heartbeat. I was not in trouble. The three people staring at me belonged by family right. They were my in-laws, Sari's brother Tyday, with his arm in a sling, Uncle Doge, and Mother Gota. Of the three, only the old woman ever said much, and nothing she said was ever anything I wanted to hear. She could find the bad side of anything and complain about it forever. What? I asked. Uncle Doge countered. Did you drift away again? He sounded troubled. When did you go? Did you gore? It wasn't that. That hasn't happened for a while. All three continued to stare at me like I had something hanging out of my nose. What? Uncle Doge said, there is something different about you. Shit. God damned right there is. I lost a wife that meant more to me than... I clamped down in the rage. I turned toward the door. No good. Smoke was in a wagon headed south. They continued to stare at me. It was like this every time I came back after going out without letting Tyday tag along. They didn't like me getting out of their sight. That, and their stares, gave me a little shiver of the sort of feeling Croker got every time he looked at one of the Nguyen Bao. Sari being gone left a vacuum bigger than the one that emptied my heart. She had been the soul that made this weird bunch work. Uncle Doge asked, do you wish to walk the path of the sword? The path of the sword, the complex of ritualized exercises associated with his two-handed longsword style of fighting, could become almost as restful and free of pain as was walking with the ghost. Although Uncle Doge has been teaching me since I became part of the family, it's still difficult for me to get into the sort of trance the path requires. Not now. Not tonight. I'm tired. Every one of my muscles aches. Yet another way I was going to miss Sari. That green-eyed angel had been an artist at massaging out the accumulated tensions of the day. We were speaking Nguyen Bao, which I used fairly well. Now Mother Gota demanded, what you doing, you? You hide from your own, in her abominable Taglian. She refuses to believe she doesn't speak the language like a native. Work. Even without the old man's paranoia, I would have kept smoke to myself. Hell, I'm taking a huge risk just mentioning him in these pages, even though I'm scribbling them in a language hardly anyone down here even speaks, let alone reads. Soulcatcher is out there somewhere. Our precautions against her discovering smoke are more elaborate than those keeping the Radisha and the Shadow Master away. Catcher was in the palace not long ago. She stole those annals that Smoke hid before his disaster. I'm pretty sure she did not notice Smoke himself. The network of confusion spells around him is supposedly extremely subtle on its fringes, so that even a player as powerful as Soulcatcher would not notice the misdirection unless she was really focused on finding something like it. I told them, I just talked to the captain. He said the headquarters group will leave tomorrow or the next day.
You're still determined to go?
Uncle Doge nodded. He didn't seem emotional when he reminded me, we too have a debt to repay. The few material possessions the three shared were packed and piled by the apartment door already. They'd been ready to go for days. I was the one who needed to focus and finalize my preparations. I had lied to Croker when I had said I was ready to travel. I'm going to bed now. Don't wake me up for anything but the end of the world. Chapter 4. Sleep is not an escape from pain.
In sleep there are dreams. In sleep I go places more horrible than those I walk when I'm awake. In dreams I still go back to Dejigori, to the death and disease, the murder and the cannibalism, and the darkness. In dreams, Sari still lives, whatever the horror of the place she walks. That night, my dreams did not restore me to the wonder of Sari's company. I remember only one. It came first as a shadow, an all-enveloping malice full of playful cruelty, as though I was sinking to the soul of a spider that enjoyed tormenting its victims. The malice did not take note of me. I passed through to its other side, and there the dream wrenched sideways, twisted, and took on life, though it was a life entirely of black and white and grays. I was in a place of despair and death. The sky was lead. Bodies rotted around me. The stench was strong enough to drive the buzzards away. The sick vegetation was coated with what looked like thick grasshopper spit. Only one thing moved, a distant flock of mocking crows. Even amidst my horror and revulsion, I felt that the scene was familiar. I tried to hang on to that thought, to pursue it, to sustain my sanity by ferreting out why I would know a place I'd never been. I stumbled and tripped across a plain of bones. Pyramids of skulls were my mile marks. My foot slipped on a baby skull that spun and went rattling off to the side. I fell, and fell, and then I was in another place. I am here. I am the dream. I am the way to life. Sari was there. She smiled at me, then she was gone. But I clung to her smile as the only thing capable of letting me keep my head above the waters of a sea of insanity. I was in that other place. It was a place of golden caverns where old men sat beside the way, frozen in time, alive but unable to move so much as an eyelash. There, insanity slashed the air like a million dueling razors. Some were covered with glittering webs of ice, as though a million fairy silkworms had spun them into cocoons of delicate threads of frozen water. An enchanted forest of icicles hung from the cavern roof. I tried to dash forward, past the old men, to get out of that place. I ran as you run in dreams, slowly going nowhere. And then the horror worsened as I realized that I knew some of those mad old men. I ran harder into the treacly resistance of animate evil laughter. I swung wildly at whoever was touching me, flung my hand under my pillow to recover the dagger hidden there. A powerful blow slammed my wrist as it came into the light. A strong voice snapped, "Morgan!" I focused. Uncle Doge stood over me. He looked grave, troubled. Tai Dei stood near the foot of my bed, where he could take me from behind if I jumped up at Doge. Mother Gota stood in the doorway, agitated. Uncle Doge said, "You were screaming in a language none of us knows. We found you wrestling with the darkness when we arrived." I was having a nightmare.
"I know."
"Huh?"
"That was obvious. Sari was there."
For one instant, Mother Gota's face became a mask of rage. She muttered something softly and too quickly for me to follow, but I did catch the name Hong Tre and the word witch. Sara's grandmother Hong, long dead, was the only reason her family had accepted our relationship. Hong Tre had given her blessing. Kidam, Sara's grandfather, also gone now, had claimed his wife possessed the second sight. Perhaps. I had seen her forecasts work out during the siege of Dejigori. Mostly, they had been very sibylline, very vague, though. I had heard Sari described as a witch, too, on one occasion. "What is that smell?" I asked. The shakes had left me. Already I could recall details of the nightmare only through determined effort. "There a dead mouse in here?" Uncle Doge frowned.
"This was not one of your journeys through time?"
"No, it was more like a trip to hell."
"Do you wish to walk the path of the sword?"
The path was Doge's religion.
his main reason for being, it sometimes seemed. Not right away. I want to get this down while I still remember it all. It might be important. Some of it seemed familiar. I swung my feet to the floor, aware that I was still being scrutinized intently. There was a lot more of that now that Sari was gone. It was not yet time to make a point of it. I went to my writing area, settled, and got to work. Uncle Doge and Tai Day found their wooden practice swords and began to loosen up on the other side of the room. Mother Gota continued to talk to herself as she got busy cleaning up. As long as she was in the mood, I even let her help with my mess, offering suggestions from the corner of my mouth just often enough to keep her simmering. Chapter 5. The great, dark, ragged square settled slowly through the air, rocking unpredictably in winter's icy breath. A screech of pain soared up above the complaints of the wind. Twice, the tattered carpet tried to set down atop the tower where the Shadow Master stood waiting. Twice the wind threatened it with disaster. The carpet's master howled again and descended 50 feet to a larger and safer landing area atop Overlook's massive wall. The Shadow Master cursed the weather. This winter gloom was almost as bad as night. Here, there, shadows came to life in unpredictable corners. All his labor and genius could not take away every cranny where they might lurk. In his ideal world, he would halt the sun itself directly above the fortress, where it could sear the heart out of the night and slay the terrors that lurked within. Long Shadow did not go down to meet his henchman, the Howler. He would make the deformed little cripple come to him. In conversation, he could pretend that they were equals, but that was not true. A day would come when the Howler would have to be disposed of altogether, but that time was a long way off yet. Those damnable nuisances from the Black Company had to be buried first. Taglios had to be chastised with fire and shadow. Its priests and princes had to be expunged. Senjak had to be taken and milked of her every dark secret. Then she had to be destroyed, utterly, and for all time. Her mad flighty sister Soulcatcher had to be hunted down, murdered, and her flesh thrown to wild dogs. Long Shadow giggled. Much of that he had said aloud. When he was alone, he did not mind verbalizing his thoughts. His list of people to be rid of grew almost daily. Here were two more now. The first two faces to rise from the stairwell were those of the strangler Narayan Singh and the child, his deceivers called the Daughter of Night. Long Shadow met her eyes only for a moment. He turned to look out over the devastation north of Overlook. A few fires still burned in the ruins. The child was barely 4, but her eyes were windows to the very heart of darkness. It seemed almost as if her monster goddess Kina sat behind those hollow pupils. She was almost as frightening as those living wisps of darkness that, because he could command them, gave him the title Shadow Master. She was a child only in flesh. The thing inside was ages older and darker than the dirty, skinny little man who served as her guardian. Narayan Singh had nothing to say. He stood at the edge of the parapet and shuddered in the chill wind. The child joined him. She did not speak either, but she showed no interest in the ruined city. Her attention was on him. For a half a heartbeat, Long Shadow feared she could read his mind. He stirred his long, bony frame toward the stairwell, concerned that Howler was leaving him alone too long with these bizarre creatures. He was startled to find the Nard General Mogaba, his leading commander, coming up the steps behind the little sorcerer, engaged in a vigorous conversation in an unfamiliar tongue. "Wow?" The Howler was floating in the air, as he often did even when not piloting his carpet. He spun himself around.
"The story is the same from here to the plain of Charandaprash, and east and west as well. The quake spared no one. though the damage becomes smaller, the farther north one travels.
Long Shadow turned instantly, stared south. Even in winter's advancing gloom, that plain up there seemed to glitter. Now it even seemed to mock him, and for a moment he regretted the impulse that had led him to challenge it so many years ago. He had gained all the power he'd dreamed of then, and hadn't known a moment of peace since. By its very existence, the place beyond Shadowgate taunted him. Root of his power, it was also his bane. He saw no evidence that the quake had disturbed anything there. The gate, he believed, should be proof against all disasters. Only one tool could open the way from the outside in. He turned back to find the child smiling, one white tooth showing like a diminutive vampire fang. She combined the scariest effects of both her mothers. Howl a shriek to shriek he cut short partway through.
The destruction leaves us no choice but to defer the labors of empire till the populace can sustain them once more.
Long Shadow raised a bony, gloved hand to his face to adjust the mask he always wore in company. What did you say? He must have heard wrong.
Consider the city before you, my friend. A city which exists only to build this fortress ever taller and stronger. But those who live there must eat in order to have the strength to walk. They must have shelter from the elements, else they weaken and die. They must have some warmth and water that does not lead them to their deaths with dysentery. I will not coddle them. Their only purpose is to serve me.
Which they can't do if they're dead, the Black General observed. The gods have taken a dislike to us lately. This earthquake hurts us more than all the armies of Taglios have in all the years of this war.
That was a hearty exaggeration, Long Shadow knew. His three fellow Shadow Masters were dead. Their great armies had perished with them, but he got the message. The situation was grim.
You came to tell me that?
It was presumptuous of the General to come to Overlook unbidden, but Long Shadow forgave him. He had a soft spot in his heart for Mogaba, who seemed much like his own younger self. He indulged the Gnar, where he would have endured far less from his other captains.
I came to ask you one more time to reconsider your orders, forcing me to remain immobile at Charandabrash. After this disaster, more than ever, I'll need flexibility to buy time.
It was an old, old argument. Long Shadow was weary of it.
If you cannot carry out your orders as given, General, without questioning everyone and nagging me continuously, then I'll find someone who will. That fellow Blade comes to mind. He's done wonderful things for us.
Mogaba inclined his head, said nothing. He particularly did not note that Blade's successes came because he was allowed exactly the sort of freedom of decision and movement that Mogaba had been petitioning for almost 2 years. Long Shadow's outburst was not unexpected, but Mogaba felt obligated to try for the sake of his soldiers. The Strangler Singh took a step toward the Shadow Master. His odor preceded him. Long Shadow shrank back. The little man said,
They are moving against us. There is no longer any doubt.
Long Shadow did not believe that because he did not want it to be true.
Winter has only just begun.
But when he glanced at the Howler, the crippled little sorcerer nodded his rag-covered head. He stifled a shriek stillborn.
It's true. Everywhere I look, Taglian forces are on the move. None are large, but they are everywhere, following every possible road. Singh's attempt to assassinate their top people seems to have set them off.
Singh's failed attempt, Long Shadow did not say aloud.
His own espionage resources were feeble now, but they had gotten that much back to him. The alliance with the Stranglers was very unpopular and therefore very precarious. The Deceivers were loved no more in the Shadowlands than they were in the Taglian territories. Mugaba moved his feet but held the remark, eager to force its way past his teeth. Long Shadow knew exactly what it was. The general wanted to be allowed to strike the Taglian bands before they could gather into a large force on the plain of Charandabrash.
Howler, find Blade. Tell him to deal with as many of these small forces as he can.
General?
Sir. Mugaba had to strain to keep his voice neutral.
You may send some of your cavalry north to harass the enemy, but only some and only cavalry. If I find you interpreting me as having turned you loose, you will indeed be turned loose on the other side of the Shadow Gate. It had been a long time since he had sent someone through to watch him die a cruel death. He just had no time for himself anymore. Nor could he open the way these days without the lance. The only other key had been stolen long ago by one of his dead colleagues. He did not have the necromantic power to call up their shades and compel the villain to reveal where the thing was buried.
Have I made myself clear?
Absolutely. Mugaba stood a hair straighter. The concession was not much, but it was something. The terrain north of Charandabrash was not suited to cavalry maneuvers, though, so he would have to use his horsemen as mounted infantry. Still, it was an opportunity.
Thank you, sir.
Long Shadow glanced sideways at the child, who almost never spoke. He surprised a look of complete disdain that vanished even as his gaze shifted, disappearing so quickly it seemed nothing more than a flicker of imagination. The Shadow Master let his gaze travel on to the plain of Glittering Stone. Once he'd been driven by an obsessive need to learn about that place. Now he just hated it and wished it would go away. But he needed it too. Without it, he would be feeble. No match for the likes of Howler or the woman Soulcatcher, whose madness and enmity were entirely unpredictable. She seemed a complete child of chaos.
"Where is the one called Soul Catcher?" he asked. "Has there been no sign?"
Howler, who'd had a report from a Skrinza Shadow Weaver whose circle directed a colony of spy bats, lied.
"Nothing. Though there was something strange that happened in Taglios about the time Jamadar Singh's brothers infiltrated the palace. Could have been her."
A shriek, twice as long and piercing as normal, ripped itself from the little sorcerer. He began to shake and shudder and spit. Even the child took a step back. Nobody offered to help. Chapter 6 4 days passed before Croker was ready to leave Taglios. He spent most of that time arguing with the Radisha. Their sessions were private. I was not allowed to sit in. The little I heard from Cordy Mather later suggested they had butted heads vigorously, and Cordy hadn't gotten to hear a tenth of what was said. I don't think Cordy is real pleased with his role around here anymore. More and more, the Radisha treats him the way some powerful men treat their mistresses. He's supposed to be the commander of the Royal Guards, and he's done a damned good job there, but the more he plukes the woman, the more she seems to think he's just a toy, not to be trusted with anything substantive. If he hadn't been feeling irritable about it, he wouldn't have mentioned the conflict.
Same old, I asked. Expenses?
Over the years, Croker got the Radisha to buy millions of arrows, hundreds of thousands of spears and javelins, tens of thousands of lances and saddles and sabers. He filled warehouses with swords and shields. He acquired mobile artillery accompanied by ammunition caissons. He accumulated dray horses, mule and ox teams by the dozens of hundreds. He had war elephants and work elephants, lumber enough to raise new cities, 1,000 unassembled box kites big enough to lift a man.
Same old, Mather admitted. He tugged angrily at his tangled brown hair.
He apparently expects this to go bad.
This. The winter offensive. That's what the squabbling was about. Starting to accumulate replacement stuff now in case this goes bad.
That sounded like the old man. He could never make enough preparations. Which was probably why, as the passion of his response to the Strangler raid waned, he seemed ever less eager to throw everything into the fray. But knowing Croker, the arguments could be a diversion, too. He might just be trying to scare the Radisha into being reluctant to pull any political stunts while he was away.
He was close to the line.
What do you mean?
There's a point where the woman just won't argue anymore.
Oh, enough said. I understood. If the old man went any further, he would have to exercise his warlord's powers and place the princess under arrest. And would that ever stir up a nest of vipers?
He'd do it, I told Mather. I assumed word would get back to the woman, but not over war material, I don't think. If the Prabhendra Dra and Radisha don't live up to their promises to help the company get back to Kadavar, though, the captain could turn unpleasant. Taking us back to the company's origins in fabled Kadavar had been Croker's main passion for nearly a decade now. If you pressed him a little, sometimes an almost fanatical determination shimmered behind the usual coterie of masks he presents to the world. I hoped Cordy would take that message to his bedmate. Also, I was kind of poking an anthill with a stick to see if, in his funk, he would reveal the royal thinking about our quest. It wasn't something the prince and his sister discussed, mostly because the Prabhendra Dra had taken a liking to life in the field and just did not see his sister anymore. Walking with the ghost told me nothing. But smoke was evidence in his own way. It was his terrified determination to keep the company away from Kadavar that had led him to defect to the Shadow Master and thereby put himself into a position where he might be stricken. As Lady noted in her contribution to these annals, the rulers of Taglios, both religious and lay, have no more love for us than they do for the Shadow Masters. But we've been gentler, and if we vanish from the stage prematurely, they will have only a short time to regret our passing. Long Shadow has no use whatsoever for priests. He exterminates them wherever he finds them, which may be one more reason why Blade deserted to his cause. Mather's old friend has the most pernicious case of priest hatred I've ever encountered.
How do you feel about Blade? I asked.
The question would divert Mather from wondering about my agenda.
I still don't understand. It just doesn't make any sense. Did he catch them doing it?
I don't think so.
I knew. I had walked with the ghost. Smoke can take me almost anywhere, even the past, back almost to the very moment when the demon burst in upon him and drove him into hiding in the farthest shadows of his mind. But even after having used smoke to go observe the actual furious encounter between Blade and the old man, alcoholically enhanced, and indeed over Blade's too obvious interest in Lady, I still did not understand. But I'll tell you, with the Prince and Blade and Willow Swan and about every other guy in town drooling all over themselves every time Lady walks by, I don't know as I blame him for finally blowing up.
Just about as many guys looked at your wife the same way.
She was probably the most beautiful woman any of them ever saw.
You didn't blow?
I think that's a compliment, Cordy. Thanks. For me and Sari both. You want me to be honest? I think it was more than Lady. I think the old man thinks Blade was planted on us somehow.
Huh?
Yeah. But you gotta know his background. Cordy was born in my end of the world. He knew the way things were. He spent years dealing with the 10 who were taken. Those monsters laid out schemes that took decades to unfold.
And some are still around?
Why Blade in particular?
Because we don't know anything about him. Except that You dragged him out of an alligator pit or something. And you do know about me and Willow?
Yes. I didn't explain that my company brothers, Otto and Hagop, had gone all the way back to the Empire and, in passing, had rooted around in the pasts of army deserters Cord Woodmather and Willow Swan. That didn't leave Mather feeling comfortable. Too bad. It never hurt to have our paranoia worry somebody else so much they behaved themselves. I glanced at Tide. He was always there, but I never forgot that. He might be my bodyguard and brother-in-law, and might owe me for saving the lives of some of his family, and I might even like him fairly well, but I never talked about anything substantial in front of him using Taglian or Nguyen Bao unless there was no other choice. Maybe the old man's paranoia was rubbing off on me. Maybe it came from how Taide and Uncle Doge and Mother Gota sometimes seemed almost indifferent to Sara's murder. They acted as though the death of Taide's son Totan was 10 times more important. They'd chosen to stay with me, to take part in the journey south, to extract revenge, then seemed to give the matter a little more thought. For me, Sari's memory is a holy thing, due its moments every day. Me thinking about Sari is not a good thing, though. Every time I do, I want to run to Smoke. But Smoke is not there for me now. One Eye did get him out of town, and even with the little wizard unlikely to be in a hurry, the Ghost Walker was getting farther and farther away. Chapter 7 Kroker sent word that he wanted to see me. I went to his hole in the wall. Started to knock, but heard voices inside. I paused, glanced at Taide. He was not big and not handsome, and was always so impassive you couldn't begin to guess what he was thinking. At the moment, though, he didn't appear to have heard anything he shouldn't. He just stood there, scratching around the splints on his broken arm. Then there was a raucous outbreak that sounded like crows squabbling. I pounded on the door. The noise stopped instantly.
Enter!
I did so in time to see a huge crow flap out the one small window in Croker's cell. A twin of the first perched atop a coat rack that looked like it had been rescued from the gutter. Kroker didn't much care about material things.
You wanted me?
Yeah, couple of things.
He spoke Forsberger from the start. Taide wouldn't get it, but Cordy Mather would if he happened to be listening. And so would the crows. We're going to pull out before sunrise. I've decided. A few of the top priests are starting to think I won't do them the way Lady did, so they're trying to push a little here and there, test the waters. I figure we'd better hit the road before they get me tied up in knots. That didn't sound quite like him. When he made deaf-mute signs as he finished, I knew the speech was for other consumption, even if it was factual. Kroker pushed a folded scrap of paper across. Take care of that before we go. Make sure you don't leave any evidence to tie it to us. What? That didn't sound good at all.
Be ready to move. If you really have to drag the in-laws along, have them ready to go too. I'll send word.
Your pets tell you anything I need to know? Like I didn't know that they were not his pets at all, but spies or messengers from Soulcatcher.
Not lately.
Don't worry about it. You'll be the first to know. This was one of those points where the paranoia grabbed me. I couldn't be sure of the actual relationship between Kroker, Soulcatcher, and those crows. I had to take him completely on faith at a time when my faith in everything was being tested severely on every hand.
That's it? That's it. Make sure you get everything you need. It won't be long.
I opened the scrap of paper by the light of one of the few lamps illuminating the corridor between Kroker's apartment and mine. I made no attempt to keep Taide from seeing it. He's illiterate. Plus, the note was written in the formal language of Juniper, as though to a bright 6-year-old, which was lucky for me since I have only a vague familiarity with the language from documents dating back to the time the company spent there before I joined. Soulcatcher was dead in those days. I suppose that's why Kroker chose to use that language. It was one he felt she was unlikely to know. The message itself was simple,
It instructed me to take the annals I'd recaptured from Soulcatcher, who'd stolen them from where Smoke had had them hidden from us, and conceal them in the room where we'd kept Smoke hidden. I wanted to go back and argue. I wanted to keep them with us, but I grasped his reasoning. Soulcatcher, and everyone else with an interest in keeping us and those annals apart, would assume that we would keep them close till we could decipher them. Out there in the field, we wouldn't have time to worry about protecting them. So we might as well hide them in a place that, right now, only the Radishan knew existed. Shit, I said softly in Taglian. No matter how many languages I learn, I always find that word useful. It has pretty much the same meaning in every tongue. Taide didn't ask. Taide almost never does. Behind me, more than the next lamp away, Croker came out of his cell with a black blob perched on his shoulder. That meant he was going to see somebody native. He thought the crows intimidated the Taglians. I told Taide, this is something I have to handle myself. Go tell Uncle Doge and your mother that we'll be leaving sometime during the night. The captain has decided.
You must accompany me partway. I cannot find my way in this great tomb.
He sounded like he meant it, too.
Nguyen Bao keep their feelings well hidden, but I saw no reason why someone who had grown up in a tropical swamp should feel at home inside an immense pile of stone. Especially since all his past experience with cities and big buildings had been negative in the extreme. I hurried to get him back into territory he knew well enough to walk alone. I had to get into Croker's cell fast before he and his feathered friend returned. That's where we were keeping the books right now. We did not want anyone to know we had them, though Soulcatcher surely suspected if she was aware that they'd been stolen from her where she'd hidden them. What a convoluted game. I felt my wrist to make sure I still wore the loop of string that was really an amulet one I had given me, so I would be immune to all the spells of confusion and misdirection around the chamber where we kept Smoke. Even before I collected the books, noting that Croker had shooed all crows, closed the window, and covered it with a curtain, I was thinking how best to conceal them once I had them where Croker wanted them to go. It wouldn't be long after we left that the Radishah would start wondering who was taking care of the wizard now. My bet was that she would start looking for him. She was stubborn enough to find her way to the room. Though she had shown little interest in Smoke lately, she'd never given up hope of bringing him back. If we enjoyed many successes against the Shadow Master, she would want his help even more. Everything we did seemed to have potentially unpleasant consequences. Chapter 8.
When the old man decides to move, he moves. It was still tomb dark when I left the palace and found him waiting with two of the giant black stallions that had come down from the north with the Black Company. Specially bred during the ladies' heyday, with sorcery instilled into their very bones, they could run forever without getting tired and could outrace any mundane steed. And they were almost as smart as a really stupid human. Croker grinned down at my in-laws. They were completely nonplussed by this development. How were they supposed to keep up? Kind of pissed me off, too. I'll handle it, I said in Nguyen Bao. I handed Taide my stuff, climbed the monster Croker had brought for me. It had been a long time since I'd ridden one, but this one seemed to remember me. It tossed its head and snorted a greeting. You too, big boy. I took my stuff from Taide.
Where's the standard? Croker demanded.
In the wagon with one eye.
Sleepy put it there before...
You let it out of your control?
You don't ever let it out of your control.
I was thinking about giving Sleepy the job. Standard Bearer was one of the hats I wore, and not one of my favorites. Now that I'm analyst, I should be passing it on. Croker has mentioned that himself on occasion. Give me your stuff now, I told Taide, once I had mine settled in front of me. Taide's eyes got big as he realized what I intended. I told Mother Gota and Uncle Doge.
Stay on the stone road all the way and you'll catch up with the army. If you're stopped, show the soldiers your papers. Another innovation of the Liberator. More and more people involved in the war effort were being given bits of paper telling who they were and who was responsible for them. Since hardly anybody was literate, the effort didn't seem worthwhile. Maybe. But the old man always has his reasons, even when those are simply to confuse. Croker realized what I was doing just as I extended my hand to help Tide climb. He opened his mouth to raise hell. I said, "Don't bother. It ain't worth a fight." Tide looks like a skull with a thin layer of dark leather over it at the best of times. Now he looked as though he'd just heard a death sentence pronounced. "It'll be all right," I told him, realizing he'd never been on a horse. The Nguyen Bao have water buffalo and a few elephants. They don't ride those, except as children sometimes, helping with the plowing. He did not want to do it. He really did not. He looked at Uncle Doge. Doge said nothing. It was Tai Day's call. Croker must have started looking smug or something. Tai Day stared at him for a moment, shuddered all over, then extended his good hand. I pulled. Tai Day was as hard and tough as they came, but he weighed almost nothing. The horse gave me a look nearly as ugly as the one I'd gotten from my boss. The fact that they're capable of a job doesn't make the beasts eager to do it. "Whenever you're ready," Croker said.
"Go."
He headed out. The pace he set was savage. He rode like he could feel no pain. He grumbled and fussed at me to keep up. He grumbled even more after we collected a cavalry escort south of the city. The regular horses had no hope of matching the pace he wanted to set. He had to keep waiting for them to catch up. Usually, he was well ahead, surrounded by crows. The birds came and went, and when we exchanged words, he always knew things like where Blade was, where our troops were, where there was resistance to the Taglian advance, and where there was none. He knew that Mogaba had sent cavalry north to blunt our advance. It was weird. The man just plain knew things he should not. Not without walking with the ghost. And One Eye was still ahead of us, making much better time than I would have believed possible had we not been trying to catch him. Croker got over a snit after the first day. He became social again. Headed for the Goja Ford, he asked, "You remember the first time we came here?" "I remember rain and mud and misery and 100 Shadowlanders trying to kill us. Those were the days, Mergen. They were as close to hell as I want to get." And that said from the viewpoint of a man who's been a whole lot closer. He chuckled. "So thank me for this nice new road." "Thank you for the nice new road." The Taglians called it the Rock Road or Stone Road. The first time we traveled it, it had been nothing but a snake of mud. "You really think Sleepy is right for the standard bearer job?" "I've been thinking about that. I'm not ready to give it up yet." "This is the same Mergen who complained that he's always the first guy into every scrape?" "I said I've been thinking. I find I've got some extra motivation." Our other companions told me I was handling Sari's loss pretty well. I thought so myself. Croker looked back at Tai Day, who was clinging desperately to a sway-backed, dapple mare.